Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
The New York State Legislature this week wrapped up passage of a package of bills on police reform as the Senate leader delivered a very personal speech on how systemic racism has affected her life. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the first African-American woman and first woman to lead the Senate, said in her speech that she's often talked about her father, a World War II veteran who served in a segregated U.S. Army. And she said often that as a mother of three sons and four grandchildren, she lives in worry. But for the first time, she told the story of her brother Bobby, a Vietnam veteran who served a decade as a New York City transit cop until he quit. She says her brother was a good police officer, but did not believe that he could change the system.
He said, Andrea, I went to the police force because I wanted to help our community. And he said he left, and he left ultimately when he was 30 years old, that he left because he was convinced that the system was created to give young black men a record.
She says he gave examples of what he'd seen.
He saw like two white kids fighting. They would be brought down to the station and their families would be called. And then he saw two black kids fighting. They'd be brought down to the station and they'd be booked for assault.
The Senate leader also for the first time told of one of her sons at the age of 18 who was with two friends on the other side of town when they were stopped and frisked by police. Nothing illegal was found on them.
By the end of that interaction, I met Stephen in the emergency room with a fractured nose. Anybody knew that Stephen would never have resisted.
She spoke as the Senate and the Assembly passed a measure to create a permanent unit within the State Attorney General's office. It will investigate allegations of police misconduct that result in the death of a New Yorker. It codifies into law a 5-year-old executive order issued by Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Announce the results.
In relation to calendar 676.
Senator Jamal Bailey is the bill's sponsor.
This package of legislation has been something that I will never forget, especially in the time of crisis and COVID that we're in. People often forgot about their own health infirmities and their own concerns about contracting COVID because it was that important to make sure that they were in the streets, to make sure their voices were heard, that enough is enough. Your voices have been heard.
Other measures approved earlier in the week ban police chokeholds, require state troopers to wear body cameras, and repeal a section of civil rights law known as 50A. Many police forces and local governments used it to shield police disciplinary records from the public. Another bill makes it a hate crime to falsely make race-based claims on a 911 call. Governor Cuomo is expected to sign the measures. Senate Leader Stewart-Cousins says passage of the bills give her hope, but she says they alone can't fix racism in America. Most of the 23 Republicans in the Senate voted against the measure to set up the special unit within the Attorney General's office, and all of them voted against the repeal of 50A. Several Republicans did vote for some of the other bills. None spoke publicly on the floor against the measures on Wednesday. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, New York State Legislature this week on Wednesday put the finishing touches on a package of police reform measures. The bills are meant to strengthen oversight of police in New York, criminalize the use of chokeholds, and boost transparency, so-called 50A law. And the measures passed with relative ease in the two chambers, of course, led by black lawmakers. We're talking about Speaker Carl Hastie of the Assembly and Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the first black woman to hold the top post in the chamber. She said on the floor, deeply personal meaning to her, and her brother was a police officer himself. And the majority leader, Crystal Peoples-Stokes, you spoke with for your Capital Connection program this week, she was on the floor giving an emotional speech about how she had to counsel her children to be humble in front of the police so that they could survive through any encounter.
Well, that's right, David. I'm not surprised. As soon as the Republicans lost the state Senate, long overdue things were going to happen. Now, some of these reforms have been languishing in the legislature for years. The idea that if a police officer does something heinous, we should know whether that person had been doing similar things in the past. The police unions have been extraordinarily strong, and their opposition can mean the defeat of a candidate. So nobody really wanted to take them on. That's all gone now. There's a huge change in the way in which this is going to operate. And the unions have really very little to fall back on because public opinion is solidly against them now. There is no good reason we shouldn't know. That's the 50A repeal, whether somebody had had disciplinary problems all along. Hey, we human beings, if we go to trial, if we're arrested, it's going to be blasted out all over the newspapers what our backgrounds are. Hey, police officers are just one more kind of human being, and to say that they are exempted from all of this is nonsense.
Well, New York City entered phase one of reopening from COVID-19 this week. The entire state now in some phase of reopening. And the question is, should we? Yes, the cases have gone down. But when you look at the national scene, 21 states right now are surging with cases and the virus is far from over.
But Governor Cuomo has warned us about this again and again and again, about getting into huge crowds, even in reaction to the terrible death of George Floyd. He has warned that if you're in a protest group and you have been close to all of these people, you should get tested and the state should help you. And he has advised that everybody go out and do that. Because we know what a virus is. We know what properties it has to be transmitted. And we know it's going to happen. Scientists have been warning, Fauci has been warning others that there's a potential comeback here for the virus. And just because you've been safe and you've worn masks and you've had people sitting at home and you didn't open the economy again, that doesn't mean that can last forever. But that also doesn't mean people should be stupid.
Well, some people might describe the incident that occurred in Buffalo as just that or worse. Buffalo's mayor now announcing several changes to police practices amid widespread calls for racial equality and police accountability. Mayor Byron Brown says the city will halt arrests for low-level nonviolent offenses like marijuana possession and make it easier for the public to view police body camera video under reforms announced Wednesday. And the police emergency response team will be replaced with a new public protection unit after two members of the former unit were videotaped shoving a 75-year-old protester who fell and cracked his head. The officers are facing felony charges. We learn now the man has cancer, and we had a bizarre, upsetting tweet by the president accusing him of being part of Antifa, which he has now publicly disclaimed.
That is so awful. This president is a great distractor. He says the most outrageous things, and these are often regarded by others as shiny objects. He puts a shiny object and everybody goes for it. This claim that this basically helpless man who was shoved to the ground, everybody's seen it. An officer comes over and tries to help, and his superior grabs him by the arm and pulls him away, is really symptomatic of what is wrong with the way in which police react. Now, there are those people, David, who are saying defund the police. I'm not one of them. The governor is not one of them. Joe Biden is not one of them. If defund means take all their money away, it's just really wrong. There are people who argue, well, that's not really what it means. Hey, it's what it says. And, you know, the idea that you could take all resources away from the police is ludicrous because we do need police. What we need is the right kind of police. We need police who are trained. We need police who have to go out into the society and do all of the work that is most important. When there is some kind of violent assault in a home, you have to be able to have a resource that will help you. On the other hand, it's a matter of retraining the police. It's a matter of recruiting the right kind of police. It's a matter of the right kind of psychological testing that police should be put through.
Isn't it also investment in those communities that have been left behind for so long, including in areas like education, mental health, and basic survival services and skills?
Look, David, we do know, and it's no surprise, that when it comes to the people who have the least, they are the most vulnerable in everything, including this COVID virus. The governor is now talking about it all the time. He's talking about education. All right, that's fine. Everybody, every student should have an equal education. All right, now you go to Scarsdale and tell me that those people who moved to that community and put tons of money to, so they have the best school system or right the top school system in the state, are going to say to the governor, sure, you go ahead and take our money away and put it somewhere else. They won't. They never have. And I guarantee you, it ain't going to start now. Nevertheless, the governor's right to say it, and he's right in what he's saying.
Shouldn't it just be funded out of the general budget rather than come from people's property tax bills?
I've always thought so. I've always thought that, you know, education is a function that the state ought to be running. And the idea that we pay enormous taxes to run our schools, we here in Massachusetts, where I live, or in New York State, is just a mistake. If you want policy like the ones that the governor is espousing right now, you have to have the power to do that, and the power to do that is in the power to support everybody equally.
And it all requires money, which the state certainly doesn't have. It's relying on the federal government to bail out much of its debt. The governor is calling for major upgrades to things like LaGuardia and other infrastructure. That's all going to cost a lot of money. How are we going to get it?
Well, first of all, that was all before the pandemic. You know, the governor's reconstruction projects for the airports and everything else. He is saying we can't do this without the federal help. The president of the United States is in no mood to help the blue states. We know that because of the kinds of taxation policies that he has put in place where we can't deduct state and local taxes. He knew what he was doing, and he knew who he was punishing. When the governor has asked for tunnels from New Jersey into New York that will stand the test of time and will not collapse, he's not getting it. The governor is saying, I have to have this. We have to have it. The president is sitting on his hands. He may, in the end, have to do something, because there are a lot of Republican governors, by the way, who need this money also. But don't put it past them to say, figure out a way that the Republican states get it and the Democrats don't.
Will we have to negotiate a tax raise or taxing the rich with the leaders of the legislature in order to do it?
That's what he faces. Either we're going to fire 20% of the teachers, he's talking about a 20% cut in their budgets, where do you think that money is coming from? Or he's going to have to raise taxes. It seems to me if the services are at stake and people demand them, he'll raise the taxes, but he'll want to do it being pulled to it by the liberals in the state assembly and Senate.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With the U.S. economy in tatters, two New York State lawmakers have come up with a plan inspired by the economic crisis brought by the Great Depression. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
109th District Assemblywoman Pat Fahey, a Democrat, says the Great Depression included the country's longest period of unemployment, above 14% from 1931 to 1940. She notes that today unemployment is in the 15% range as a result of the economic upheaval caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, with small businesses bearing the brunt of the fallout. She says small businesses have also suffered as a result of violent protests stemming from the death of George Floyd.
The University of Chicago just 2 weeks ago estimated that 42% of the jobs lost under the pandemic will not be coming back. To me, that's one of the most jaw-dropping statistics I have seen.
With 17 million Americans now jobless, 2 million of them in New York, according to Fahey, she and fellow Democrat Senator Rachel May of the 53rd District are borrowing a page from FDR's old playbook. They aim to create a Works Progress Administration, a short-term public jobs and works program to put unemployed New Yorkers back to work, specifically targeting
low-income, low-wage workers, youth, again, the millennials and younger, as well as people of color. One statistic on this, 39%, that is the share, 39% of working people who earn less than $40,000 a year have lost their jobs or were furloughed in March, April. That compares to 13% of households earning over $100,000.
According to Fahey's office, roughly $92 billion in today's dollars was invested in infrastructure and cultural projects in the 1930s. At its peak, the WPA employed nearly 3 million people, and the impact is still felt today in parks, infrastructure, and art. Fahey envisions the New York WPA as part of a multi-pronged solution to multi-pronged problems, including the COVID economic upheaval, social unrest, and unemployment. The bill's co-sponsor, Senator May, represents Central New York.
We have beautiful parks and buildings and infrastructure projects to thank for the WPA for. And now in the 21st century, if we have a new WPA, it will employ people the same way in meaningful jobs of lasting value. As in the 1930s, we have to marshal government resources to boost employment. And this bill can position us to do it strategically so that we can improve our long-term resilience and our quality of life.
May and Fahey envision programs modeled after WPA initiatives that paired creative Americans with the country's rich culture at a time of intense need. Maureen Sager is director of the Upstate Alliance for the Economy.
The same as the original WPA project did the same thing, right? That investment in artists led to the abstract expressionist movement, which put New York at the cultural forefront of the world. It remains there.
The bill also calls for mobilizing a new federal green workforce to enable projects like constructing seawalls, building renewable energy infrastructure, and restoring habitats to benefit both the economy and the planet. Fahey says the legislative session wraps up Wednesday, and then lawmakers will wait on the federal government to act. She adds, some speculate state legislators will be back in Albany in July either way.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Following many calls to hold graduations outdoors, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced he will permit such ceremonies beginning at the end of the month. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
Governor Cuomo says the ability to hold outdoor graduations is contingent upon no further COVID-19 outbreaks or a significant change for the worse in metrics that have been used to measure progress of the state as well as counties and regions.
We're going to allow socially distanced graduations outdoors with up to 150 people total beginning June 26th. That's when the schools start to graduate, high schools, and it gives us a couple of weeks between now and then. God forbid the number changes, but schools need to plan with the progress we've made so far, and if we continue this trajectory, we'll be able to do that.
Republican Assemblyman Colin Schmidt on June 2nd sent more than 3,000 petition signatures from local residents to Governor Cuomo supporting socially distant in-person summertime graduation ceremonies.
Our state was one of the last states to authorize in-person socially distant graduation ceremonies. It is the right move. I was proud to call on the governor very early on to do so. And we had over 5,000 family members, friends, educators, and graduates themselves sign a petition that we sent to the governor urging him to do this. So this is a big win.
Schmidt, whose 99th district includes a portion of Orange County and one town in Rockland, had formally requested that Cuomo and the state education department allow the outdoor graduations, a request that came the week before he sent the petition.
I'm urging school districts that I represent to take all steps necessary to plan their ceremony or additional in-person ceremonies as appropriate.
Others had been calling on Cuomo to allow in-person socially distanced graduations, including State Senator Shelley Mayer of the 37th District, who chairs the Education Committee. She spearheaded a letter at the end of May, a day after New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy announced he would allow such ceremonies. Fellow Democratic Senator Jen Metzger is one who signed on to Mayer's letter.
Look, this is like the most important milestone in a young person's life. You know, they've been building up to this day. Our high school seniors from the age of five, it's a huge turning point for them, whether they're going to college or entering the workforce, and for their families and for, you know, their teachers and everyone. And they should be able to have this day, especially since kids have had to give up a lot during this pandemic.
The May 27th letter refers specifically to holding high school graduations outdoors and in person in July by maintaining social distancing and following public health guidelines set by the State Department of Health. And now, this can happen sooner. Metzger says that before Cuomo's announcement, a number of schools had been lining up graduation ceremonies at a drive-in movie theater in Warwick in Orange County. She says other parts of her 42nd district were searching for creative ways to hold graduations and hoping for outdoor ceremonies.
I've talked to school administrators in Sullivan County. You know, they don't have a drive-in, but their kids, their parents, they really want to be able to have this ceremony.
Again, Schmidt of New Windsor.
I feel very positive about this development of news and our graduates who have achieved so much, who have gone through a lot just like all of us, deserve this recognition and achievement of as normal a graduation ceremony as possible, and they're going to be able to have that now.
Meantime, the Mid-Hudson region started phase two of reopening Tuesday.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. At a time when the border is closed, the North Country Chamber of Commerce recently hosted a virtual conversation with a key Canadian official to discuss cross-border issues. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley joined the video conference.
Nearly 100 people from both sides of the border tuned in to hear from the Acting Counsel General of Canada in New York on cross-border economic, social, and political relations. Kawar Nassim says he speaks frequently with the local chamber about legislation and the movement of goods across the border, and this is a time to reinforce those conversations.
This is a time of enormous uncertainty for all of us on both sides of the border, and many of us feel unmoored and unsure about what the future holds for us. And I think that events like today's are what ground us and what define us and what allow us to get to some degree of comfort in the face of this enormous uncertainty. You know, I think that this is why this conversation is essential. The Canada-U.S. relationship is the closest in the world. No two countries share the level of integration and partnership that we do. We need to promote and protect that relationship. It is a great thing, and it is something that sustains both of us.
Nassim began by describing how COVID-19 has affected Canada.
We see the numbers every day in the news in the United States. Let me share with you that in Canada, we have over 190,000 confirmed cases and over 7,000 deaths. We have over 8 million Canadians who have applied for what's called the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit. That's roughly 20% in a country of 37 million. We've put in a number of programs to assist Canadians, and our deficit will now reach its highest level in 20 years. So The economic response that we have put forward is the largest single program that we have put in place since the Second World War.
The Council General says since NAFTA was introduced, the cross-border economy has grown threefold, and the newly negotiated USMCA will provide security and stability to the shared economy.
There is no debate in Canada as to the merits and benefits of free trade. The USMCA is a good document. It addresses concerns. It modernizes the agreement. It's a progressive agreement. And, you know, it was not an easy haul, but over 2.5 years, we were able to get this agreement over the finish line where it's been ratified by all three countries now, and we'll go into implementation in July.
Chamber President Gary Douglas read a number of questions that were submitted in advance due to the virtual nature of the seminar.
How can we best recover together? Is reshoring of manufacturing from Asia and other parts of the world a shared opportunity potentially?
It's both an opportunity and a risk. We have to ensure that we don't damage the relationship between Canada and the United States.
One submitted question pondered the continuing closure of the Canadian border.
From Canada's perspective, what metrics or conditions will be required to relax the cross-border restrictions after June 21? Is there any potential for regional differentiations or allowance of near border travel by Canadians into regions like the North Country where the health situation is positive?
The situation is being driven by a consideration of the safety and security of the ability to reduce the transmission of the disease. And, you know, the governments on both sides are going to be very careful about international travel. These are the kinds of discussions that are happening on an ongoing basis.
Reuters reported on Tuesday that the U.S. and Canada will likely extend the non-essential travel ban, currently set to expire on June 21st, to the end of July.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2024. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustino.